KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome to Speakers Forum, a venue for writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. Today's guest is playwright Tony Kushner, the creator of Angels in America, a two-part play inspired by the tragic rise of the AIDS epidemic. Angels in America debuted on Broadway in 1993, winning the Pulitzer Prize for Drama and the Tony Award for Best Play that same year. The play is set in New York in 1985, an especially dark time in the crisis. Since the first diagnoses of cases in 1980, gay men had become the target of harassment and discrimination. The Reverend Jerry Falwell called AIDS the wrath of God upon homosexuals. White House Communications Director Pat Buchanan later called it nature's revenge on gay men. It was not until May of 1987, near the end of his second term, that President Reagan publicly addressed the epidemic. By the end of that year, over 40,000 Americans had died of the disease. By 1990, a million Americans had been infected. Tony Kushner is best known for Angels in America, but has gone on to earn acclaim as a screenwriter as well. His screenplay for the film Lincoln was nominated for an Academy Award in 2013. That same year, he received the National Medal of Arts, the highest award given to artists by the United States government. Tony Kushner spoke with writer, editor, and It Gets Better Project co-founder Dan Savage at Town Hall Seattle on May 10th, 2014. Please be advised, the following program contains language of an adult nature.
So we've been talking for about a half an hour backstage about musicals. We could just keep talking musicals and...
We could sing.
I want to...
Sister.
I want to sing from MAME.
Hit it. Go, I'll go.
We'll always be bosom buddies, friends, sisters, and pals. I want to read a quote from Angels in America.
I once saw... I think it was Song Sisters at like some New York theater award thing, and these two poor women came out, and one stuck her head out and went, sister, and the other one from the other side of the stage went, sisters, and Elaine Stritch was in the audience and said, can't you just smell disaster?
Nothing stinks higher to heaven than bad theater.
Yes.
You can smell bad. You can smell it outside the building.
Yes.
When a bad play is going on.
It's the worst thing in the world. It's that great line from The Simpsons when Homer turns to Marge at the Mall of America and there's some dancing thing is going on and he turns to Marge and says, I've seen plays that are worse than this, Marge. Plays!
Okay, speaking of plays, but good ones, this line in Angels in America, Roy Cohn, says this. He's having a conversation with his doctor after his doctor has diagnosed him with AIDS, and his doctor suggests or states that he is a homosexual, and Roy Cohn rejects this this label. To someone who doesn't understand this, homosexual is what I am because I sleep with men, but this is wrong. Homosexuals are not men who sleep with other men. Homosexuals are men who, in 15 years of trying, cannot get a anti-discrimination bill through the city council. They are men who know nobody and who nobody knows. Now, Henry, does that sound like me? What he's saying is that homosexuals are powerless. They have
that
no...
was great. You've got the part. It's...
but they're powerless if they have no clout, they have no political sway, they can't make happen. Today in Arkansas, in Eureka Springs, gay and lesbian couples are getting married. The President of the United States supports marriage equality. The State Department has been fighting for the rights of queers in Nigeria and Russia, of all places. Seattle elected a gay mayor. In the two-plus decades since you wrote those lines, since you put those lines in Roy Cohn's mouth, what the f*** happened? What changed?
You know, I mean... we happened, the community happened. I mean, the LGBT community put up a very powerful fight. And you know, one of the glories of American democracy, I think, is this gesture towards inclusion. It was not necessarily exactly what the Founding Fathers planned, but it's, there are the seeds of it in the original debates over the Constitution, in the legislation and amendments that followed the Civil War in the 19th century. A machinery was set up that allows for a social transformation to start on the grassroots level and then find its way into the halls of power and then actually transform those halls and the machineries of power and governance. And I think that that's sort of what we've been watching. Every single attempt to do this follows a different template, a different path. We actually sort of share templates. I mean, the African American civil rights movement is kind of the template for everyone trying to find a nonviolent way to effect radical social change. And feminism is indebted to it. Lesbian and gay liberation is. But, you know, I think there's been this in, I mean, it's stupid for me telling you this. You know everybody as much as I do. I think there was, you know, an incredible amount of courage and determination, especially in the generations that preceded my generation, the Stonewall generation and earlier, people who really came out at a time when it was, you know, terrifying and lonely to do it. And, you know, the unbelievable moment when the epidemic arrived, and rather than accept what the right was saying, which was that this was some sort of judgment against us rendered by, you know, Providence, the epidemic was not only faced and addressed, it actually was used as a moment to complexify and advance our politics and make sure that not only did we not go backwards, but that we moved forward through this biological catastrophe. There's nothing in all of human history exactly like that. I think it's one of the most extraordinary political accomplishments.
The LGBT civil rights movement?
Well, and specifically through the years of the epidemic, through ACT UP. I mean, I think that we didn't... I think that... I certainly was afraid at that time that things were going to fall apart in the face of this profoundly disorganizing, nightmarish thing that was happening, and not only did that not happen, I mean, you know, the people who are a lot younger than me have forgotten things, you know, like the separation between the gay community and the lesbian community, and how profound that divide used to be, and how one of the main things that bridged it, that made it go away to the extent that it's gone away, and I think that's to a fairly great extent, was the epidemic and the incredibly powerful and compassionate participation of the lesbian community in AIDS activism.
Well, you have Roy Cohn pointing out in the play, which is set in during the Reagan administration in the 80s, is that the gay and lesbian community politically had achieved nothing. And even then, when the epidemic was raging, I think, in addition to the many things that young people, young queer people, don't remember, don't know, and wouldn't have any way of finding out unless they were so motivated as to educate themselves, because they're not going to learn about queer history in their high schools, is the peril that what little we had achieved thus far seemed to be in danger of being yanked away from us. You had social conservatives, politically powerful social conservatives, calling for quarantine of queer people, of gay people.
William F. Buckley. Tattooing.
Tattoo our buttocks and our arms. I mean, you know, that was William F. Buckley's...
The great moral conscience of the American right. I mean, and you know, the evangelical right, which was at that point only really sort of climbing up on its, you know, hooves and beginning to really find its place. I mean, the invitation of these crazy people into American politics was something that was begun essentially in 1979, 1980 by the Reagan campaign. And they were, you know, using the platform that, that the Reaganites had given them to say, you know, this is God's judgment against homosexuality. And I mean, you know, when I remember one of the most powerful memories I have from the very early years of the epidemic, I was a member of a group called the Coalition for Lesbian and Gay Rights in New York. And we're the group that he's talking about in that speech. Every year, we would go to city council and ask for a non-discrimination bill. And every year we would lose. The Catholic Church would bus in a huge number of people from Queens. The Hasidic communities from Queens would come. And there was one great moment where I was sitting in the balcony at one of the first one of these that I went to. And there were these women from Queens praying on their rosaries against the bill. And then these Hasids sitting next to them, they were Lubavitchers. And Menachem Schneerson, the head of the Lubavitch movement, was testifying against the bill. And he pulled out a dollar bill from his pocket and said, "You see on this bill, it says, 'In God we trust.' This is a God, a country is a based on God, and it's in God we trust." And this woman, I'm not making this up, this Irish Catholic lady leans over to her friend and goes, "Ha, look at that Jew waving his money around." And they were like on the same side. It was just like that.
Well, the reason I asked...
And that's when I became a playwright. I mean, it was like, okay, you really can't...
That's when you became a playwright.
It was perfect.
The reason I ask about that moment of peril, you know, I came out in 1980, and right into the buzzsaw is kind of how it felt. And there was that moment in like 84 where it just felt like what little we had achieved in visibility and some sense of security, even with our own families, was about to be taken from us. When you started working on Angels in America in the 80s and prepared in first production in 1990.
I started writing it in 88.
So the play itself, about really what was the darkest moment, I think, for so many queer people, so many gay people, is infused with such joy and such ecstasy and such optimism. Were you not ground under by that sense of despair, by that fear, by that moment of peril? Did the play, when you began to write it, was it darker and more despairing than the end product, than what you finished with?
No, I started working, as I said, in 1988, and things had already started to change. Rock Hudson had died, and as silly as it is, not that he died wasn't silly, you know, he was a nice guy apparently, but it's kind of weird to think back on the history of the epidemic and the way that it was received in the American population in general. That was the watershed event. I mean, the fact that this guy that everybody's mother had grown up loving in the 50s was gay and died of AIDS suddenly made this, at least that's the way I remember it. And I think when the histories of the epidemic are written, it's going to be seen certainly as a watershed moment. AZT was already on the scene, and even though it wasn't, God knows, anything.
Helpful.
Well, it wasn't the solution, and it caused as many problems as it created, but it was something that slowed down the absolutely, rapid progress of the disease from, I mean, it was the first thing.
So you were seeing
people,
glimmers of hope in 88.
Yeah, people were
beginning. I didn't see those glimmers of hope when George H.W. Bush got elected after
the
most hateful anti-gay, the political convention in 88, the Republican political convention in Dallas, wasn't it? Or Houston, was this rabid, it's where Pat Buchanan gave his...
No, that was 92.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah. That was for me. I had this...
Marijuana's legal here now. I confuse a lot of things about the 80s and early 90s.
That's Pat Buchanan made the speech about this is the greatest, the Democratic Convention was the greatest display of ideological cross-dressing in America. And Molly Ivins wrote, his speech wasn't very good and it didn't go over well. I'm sure it sounded better in the original German. we miss her so much. I had this really strong feeling, I think everybody did, watching that convention in 92. He was saying all the things that those people were saying, most of them are still saying it, but it curdled in some way. I mean, it still got big barking laughs in the room, but it was curdling in some way. You could even see that Buchanan wasn't, he was a showman, and he wasn't happy with the way it was going over. And that's when I thought, Reagan was, Reagan was a sock puppet, but the people behind Reagan were very, very smart about how they rolled out the agenda. And it wasn't until Poppy Bush took over that the he had to deliver on the promises. But Reagan brought the fundies in and gave them absolutely nothing. They expected a theocracy in return for delivering the South to the Republican Party, and they didn't get that. He was very cautious about, Angels in America was funded by the NEA under Reagan, and we were pretty clear about what the play was going to be about. The big NEA controversy was under Poppy Bush because he had to start paying the bills that Reagan had incurred. He had to sort of start sucking up to the fundies and do the anti-abortion, the Rust Amendment, and all that, the gag laws, all that. That's on YouTube, I guess, now. But, I think that...
The first appearance of the word on YouTube, I believe. Jumping back for a second to Roy Cohn, was he a singular character in American politics, or are there Roy Cohns everywhere? Is Clarence Thomas a Roy Cohn? Is there a contemporary Roy Cohn for the gays, or was Roy Cohn really a one-off?
Well, there are always people who are enormously compromised, who are living lives of immense hypocrisy, and every 5 minutes you discover that some hideous homophobe in some state legislature somewhere has been like that. What's the guy? Where was he? In Kentucky or West Virginia? The guy who was a drag queen who's running for
Republican nomination. And
yeah,
worked
and his
as a
name
drag
was like Minerva St. John or something like that. And he was like a drag queen. And he's anyway. I was attracted to Roy partly because of receiving when I was a really little kid, a kind of an education in the McCarthy era. I just got very interested in the McCarthy era when I was like 10 years old, and reading about McCarthy, and I knew at 10 that when I was reading about Cohn and David Shine, his boyfriend, that these were gay men. Nobody said it in print because he would sue you if you said it in print and just harass you with lawsuits until you wished you were dead. So people really stayed away from overt declarations about his homosexuality. But it was clear to me that he was a Jewish guy like me and he was a gay guy like me. He was also a really terrible person, which I hoped I wouldn't grow up to be. And I was fascinated by that. So ultimately, I decided that I wanted to write about him because, I've said this a lot before, I'm a subscriber. I'm actually now on the editorial board of The Nation, and I've read The Nation since I first came to New York. Robert Sherrill, I think, who's one of the old lions of the left, wrote the obituary for Cohn when he died, and it was, as I remember it, sort of shockingly ugly and homophobic. And he really ends the thing, as I remember, gloating about what Roy's body looked like with the sores and really sort of like he got what he wanted, what he deserved. At one point in the article, sort of doing a little drive-by past the old theory that fascism and homosexuality have some sort of, consonance, that there are always gay people wherever there's something that smells like fascism, from Hitler to, Reagan. And which is not as far a trip as I think some people think.
That's going to end up on YouTube.
Good. Well, I wrote a play. That's my first play says that. So
I'm twitchy.
Nobody can say anything that they haven't said already. Greg Bordowitz, I think, was the person who said, of the two people who died in the same year, Rock Hudson and Roy Cohn, which one died the more typical AIDS death? Who was the one who died with everyone jeering and no sympathy and alone? And it was Roy Cohn, even though he was a terrible person. So in a way, I found myself surprised after a lifetime of watching him and kind of hating him, being moved by his death, and also as I started reading about him, discovering that he was loyal from the start to McCarthy. He never abandoned McCarthy, the memory of McCarthy. He never apologized. There was a kind of coherence, and I thought, this is an actual character I can write because he makes sense to himself. He's not...
Were you worried when you created such a sympathetic character out of the tattered shreds of this man's life and his malevolence? In Angels in America, we love the anti-hero, right? Breaking Bad. We love the bad boy.
Because Breaking Bad is an interesting...
Roy Cohn is really the driver, particularly of the first play in the Angels of America.
He's pretty much, I mean, you feel more sympathy for him, I think, in the second when you actually watch him die. There were times when I thought, oh, God, have I ever done it? But I, I tried to make, I mean, he was a lot of fun to write. I got sort of worried because I really enjoyed writing Roy scenes. I think where he winds up and what he is, I mean, I was trying to get at something about American conservatism, and that's actually, you know, in some ways not entirely, I think that conservatism is a thought disorder. I think that it's a, I really do. I think it's not like diagnosable and you have to be like, you know, electroshocked out of it, but I think that it's an inability to construct, you know, a coherent causal chain that starts A, B, C, D, and that keeps going until you get to something that actually feels like truth. You stop at the point that it starts to get uncomfortable, it starts to, like, threaten your privilege, and then you just don't think any further. And it manifests itself in some people as a thought disorder, and in some people, as in the president before President Obama, as a thought and language disorder. I mean, where they can't actually syntax falls apart. I worried about it. I mean, Breaking Bad is really interesting to me because what they did in that it's like this. I don't want to do any spoiler thing, but, you know, he's not an anti-hero. I mean, towards the end, I think that they did an amazing job of, like, tying up all the loose ends and proving that in one of these new, because we are in a completely new age in television, where a television show can really be like a novel. I mean, you can literally carry it around in your pocket, which is how most people are watching it, and pick it up and put it down. And that's for people like me who have this kind of incurable problem of, like, long things. Well, you know what I mean. Anyway, that may explain the origin of it, but I don't know. It's not what I mean. The people who wrote Breaking Bad proved that a show can be conceived from beginning to end. I mean, Vince Gilligan says that's not what they did, but I don't believe him. I think they must have known. He must have known somewhere where it was heading, because it ends and everything's all tied up together. I think at the end of the show, in a certain way, they wind up trying to recuperate the Bryan Cranston character and make him into something of an anti-hero who still has a moral being. What was absolutely, and I love the series very much, I'm in awe of it, but the real stunner is that, I think it's the end of the second to last season, when they just sort of glide past the pot of poison on the and you realize that this guy tried to murder a child, and all of a sudden, for me, and I think for a lot of people, you realize that you'd spent 4 or 5 seasons, because he's so brilliantly written and brilliantly acted, really wanting that guy to be a good guy, and really being unwilling to surrender to your conscience, which was saying, but he's already killed. He kills somebody in the first episode in self-defense, and then not in self-defense, and then, you know. This is a monster, and you've been watching a monster. It's like Paradise Lost. It's like Ben Johnson. It's like you've replicated the fall of man. You've fallen in love with the devil.
Tony Kushner is the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright of Angels in America, a gay fantasia on national themes. Seattle's Intimon Theater will be staging the play this summer, opening August 12th. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle and Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien.
More from Tony Kushner and Dan Savage in a moment, 929-949-KUOW. Tomorrow night, we're going to hear stories of people who come up with a great idea, devise a plan, and control for seemingly every variable. Then, once everything's in place, see things fall apart, including one psychologist's zeal to safeguard national security, possibly creating a terrorist. One community's efforts to protect an endangered bird having deadly consequences. And against all odds, a toxic lake spawning new life. Radiolab tomorrow evening at 7. Lows in the 50s tonight, mostly cloudy. For Friday, highs around 70. partly sunny. Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Children's, where generous donors support pediatric research, new facilities, and financial aid for the families of children facing illness and injury. More information at seattlechildrens.org. Support for KUOW comes from Don't Drip and Drive, protecting Puget Sound with a series of auto leaks inspection workshops for car owners, a service of the Department of Ecology and Seattle Public Utilities. Open to all. Registration at fixcarleaks.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, you're listening to Speakers Forum. Welcome back. This week, we're broadcasting a conversation with playwright Tony Kushner. In 2013, President Obama awarded Kushner the National Medal of Arts. The citation read, "Tony Kushner, for his contributions to American theater and film. Whether for the stage or the silver screen, his scripts have moved audiences worldwide, marrying humor to fury, history to fantasy, and the philosophical to the personal." The next wide-ranging segment starts with a lightning round on favorite TV shows and winds its way to Kushner's views on conservatism, the demise of homophobia, and disagreements about Blanche DuBois.
While we're on the TV subject, Game of Thrones, yes or no?
Oh, totally. I'm totally.
RuPaul's Drag Race, yes or no?
Completely addicted to RuPaul's Drag Race. I want to be a judge on RuPaul's Drag Race, and I don't know how you do that.
I'll put in a word for you.
I
was a judge.
You've done it. I remember you were a judge.
I'll get you on.
Like, how did, you know? I was sitting at...
Have you ever done drag?
I have never even tried it because I know I would really not make a pretty girl. It would be,
and I'd be one of those spackle paint and wigs. You can make a pretty girl out of anything.
No, it's thank you, dear. But I'm sure you
made a pretty girl out of me.
No, I mean, I've seen enough people in drag who, and it's really like, no, you just really look like you don't want, you know, like you don't want to look like, you know, so the rhinestone stegosaurus thing. I've never felt like I would be. I'm too self-conscious. Also, that's why I'm not an actor. I'm not very comfortable in my own body. But I love Drag Queens, and I love that show. I think that show is astounding.
I agree. That's the show I always point to when people complain to me about Modern Family and the representation on TV of gay men. It's always rich, white, upper middle class. And I always say, you want to see gay people of color, non-native English speakers, illegal immigrant gay men, gay people who've been to prison, poor, poverty, struggling, you got to watch RuPaul's Drag Race. That's where
although
there's
I have
this
to say
arc
that my,
of gay representation.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's you've never seen anything like it, and what's going on there with gender and the whole that weird thing with those guys, the straight guys who are getting married. I was like having trouble. The narrative was so complicated. It was like I couldn't... It's like French, practically, and where the guy got they made this guy who was a basketball player, and he was in drag, and then he had to go off and throw up off stage, and then it was just unbelievably weird and interesting.
I love it.
I've been waiting though since I think it was the first season, the last Lip Sync for Your Life. What was his name? Benet. The first winner of it.
Yeah. I'm terrible with names.
I'm thinking
here.
Stephen Vincent Benet, but it couldn't possibly be that. Anyway, they did that drag. Remember, they did like, and they did this whole sort of like drag improv thing about masters and slaves. And I was reading this whole sort of like Haitian Cuban colonization thing going on. It was this amazing, like dramatic. It was like a whole play in that lip sync. Watch it again, and they've never gotten back up to that level of complete genius. But maybe that can only be attained once in a lifetime.
So your most recent play, The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism with a Key to the Scriptures, which I don't think has been produced in Seattle yet.
No.
It should be. When I heard
it's in rehearsal right now at Berkeley Rep, so just down the road.
I will fly down. The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide, when I read that famous Adlai Stevenson quote leapt to mind where he was running for president against Richard Nixon, and a supporter approached him after he gave a speech, and she said to Adlai Stevenson, "You have every thinking American's vote." And he looked at her and said, "Ma'am, I need a majority." The Intelligent...
I've never heard that. That's great.
The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide, it used to sort of be a cliche of, like, gay men were very cultured and well-read and intelligent. And I think that was sort of a product of you couldn't be out and gay and dumb. because it was too dangerous a world to navigate, out and gay and dumb. You would get picked off. It seems now that there are less intelligent homosexuals rattling around and doing fine. Do you find that to be the case? When you write The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide, do you see the intelligent homosexual as the majority?
I sort of believe that most people are intelligent. I think that real stupidity is actually a kind of remarkable and rare occurrence, as opposed to, as I said before, you know, thought disorders and things that make I don't think that W is genuinely stupid. I don't think that he's, you know, Mozart, but I think that he's not genuinely stupid, but there's something really, there's a major spanner in those works. I've met in my life very few people who I thought, oh, you're really actually just kind of a poodle. I mean, you're not really entirely, you know, functioning. You're just not getting it, right?
Speaking of Republicans, today's Republicans, more evil or more stupid? And is Michelle Bachmann a character you could have created? Is she Harper Pitt with a less attractive, closeted husband and a less engaging personality?
Oh, no. Harper's like a really great person. Michelle Bachmann is really not. I mean, they are both married to gay men, but, you know.
You were just saying you've never met a truly dumb person. Have
she's
you met
not,
Michelle
I don't think
Bachmann?
Michelle is dumb. I think that, I don't think I could ever write Ronald Reagan as a character, because I don't know exactly what the level of, what the DSM-4 category he would fit into, or DSM-5, or whichever one we're on now. But there's something really, like, there was something seriously not hooked up inside. There's some kind of like as if personality thing going on in there. Famously, Edmund Morris, his official biographer, went into a massive depression. Compared him to in a memo to a convention of biographers. He said, "I can't write this biography. I'm stuck, and I can only think of the president now as a glacier. He's thick, slabby, and cold," which is a pretty good description. And then wound up writing Dutch, which is this weird kind of fiction version, because he couldn't find Reagan anywhere in there. You can't make a really interesting dramatic character unless they're internally coherent, because their internal coherence means that you have to deal with your own internal contradictions, and you have to reconcile them, you have to fight. If you don't have a core that needs to feel coherent to you, you can just be like, you know, fish on Monday and chicken on Friday, and, you know, you can be anything. It doesn't matter.
So you think there's an intelligence at work behind Michelle Bachmann's demagoguery?
I don't think that there's much evidence that she's stupid. I think that there's great evidence that she's, you know, clinically insane. I mean, not that she should be, I don't know what her treatment should be. I'm not a psychologist, but the woman
she's married to one.
Yes, she is. I know. Isn't that insane? And has 750 foster. I don't know. But when we did the play, I wrote The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide at the Guthrie and in Minneapolis. And I was walking in when the play was about to open. I was in downtown Minneapolis, and this bus drove by. And the poster for the show was on the side of the bus, and the graphic designer at the Guthrie had made the words homosexual and socialism the biggest words on the poster. So this bus came zipping by downtown Minneapolis, and I called my husband on the phone, and I said, "Well, you know, I don't know if the play is any good. I don't know what the reception's going to be, but I have to say I'm proud of that bus poster that just went by." And he said, "You should feel proud. You've written a 17-word phrase of perfectly grammatically correct English that's absolutely guaranteed to give Michelle Bachmann a heart attack, and it doesn't have a verb in it." So, you know, I don't know. I think that, like I was saying, I think that for me, the hooking up of intelligence and homosexuality is, there's an interesting dialectic, I think, for us in our politics between, you know, it's the body-brain split that's been around since Spinoza, and we, that's a big part of our politics that I think queer theory has struggled with, that I think our culture has wrestled with in various ways. The whole thing that you're talking about, I mean, the need to be at least clever and crafty to survive under a blistering level of oppression like the homophobia that was universal up until Stonewall and then, you know, took its time fading since then. And then all of a sudden, very quickly in the last few years, it's like a rout. I mean, it's really, it's stunning. But
I describe the gay rights movement as two simultaneous wars. There was a First World War happening where positions are dug in and there's all this mustard gas and the lines don't move much at all. But there was a guerrilla war, the culture war, and we were winning it. We were so far behind their lines. And then that sort of, the lines collapsed. And it was our triumph in the culture war, which was about being out to our families, about being out in our communities, about being out as a playwright. I've always looked at your work and thought, you know, if you were born 40 years earlier, you wouldn't have been Tennessee Williams, but you would have written plays like Tennessee Williams was forced to write. I mean, he's a crazy, demented product of his era, but he wrote in a code. He wrote straight people for the straight audiences who would not come see a play if there were gay characters on the stage. And gay people could enjoy Blanche DuBois as the faggot that she actually is.
Oh, I don't agree with that at all.
No, I think so. Not that I'm going to tell you.
I mean, you know, Tennessee is you know, I mean, one problem that I have with the idea that Blanche is just a drag character, I mean, you know, first of all, you know, the big part of the job of being a playwright is an extension of empathic imagination into the lives of people who are not like you, and I think that Tennessee proved himself, among many things, I mean, one of our greatest writers, to be immensely capable of imagining the inner lives of his female characters. He was one of the great writers of female characters. And, you know, Streetcar is a play about rape. And I think that if you, you know, it's, I think that's where I really part company with people that say that Blanche is a man. What the play is about, finally, ultimately, I mean, it's not about anything. It's one of the greatest plays I've ever written, and it's about everything.
Well, maybe, but the impulse is to find the gay stories in his plays because he wasn't, he didn't write gay characters, and part because you think he couldn't write gay characters.
He
existed at a time that you could.
Yeah, and the hard thing with Tennessee, I mean, you know, the drugs and the drinking destroyed him long before he stopped writing. He had graphomania. He kept writing and writing and writing and writing. And I used to think, I wrote the introduction for the Glass Menagerie 60th anniversary edition, and I spent a long time reading about him last year. And I used to think that that was a work ethic, a kind of courage. I remember when he died, Dan Rather on the CBS News saying, you know, very movingly, even though he got nothing but bad reviews for the last two-thirds of his career, he kept working every day, and I was really moved by that. The more I've come to know about him, the more I see that there was actually a kind of a craziness in the he should have written a little less, maybe. He certainly should have taken a lot fewer drugs, but, you know, who am I to judge? He was, I think that you know, the hard thing is that when he finally got to a point in history where he could start writing about gay people, and he always wrote gay characters. Tom in Glass Menagerie shouldn't be played as an out gay person, but Tom is clearly gay. And the story that the play is based on, Laura at the end of the story outs him, basically says, you know, you brought the gentleman caller over because you want to do him. And, I mean, she says it in a very subtle way, but it's kind of shocking. He didn't do that in the play. But Tom is clearly not necessarily straight, at least.
I've always felt that he should be covered in blood in the last scene during that last monologue because he's married, because he's murdered his mother and his sister.
Oh, God.
How dark is that?
I No. Don't do that.
You're listening to a conversation with Tony Kushner on Speakers Forum. Kushner is the author of Angels in America. After this break, we'll hear questions from the Town Hall Seattle audience, including which of his plays should get more attention, and a personal inquiry about a particular household chore. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
More from Tony Kushner and Dan Savage in a moment, 9:45, 94.9 KUOW. Tomorrow night on Livewire, stand-up comics Nathan Fielder, who's appeared on Bob's Burgers, Drunk History, and his own show, Nathan For You, and Andy Haynes, who's appeared on Conan, Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, and the Montreal Just for Laughs Festival. Also, journalist Joel Warner and behavioral decision theory specialist Peter McGraw talking about the great lengths they went to research and write their book, The Humor Code, a global search for what makes things funny. And music from Astoria, Oregon-based indie pop rock group Holiday Friends, all recorded with a live audience in Portland, Oregon, tomorrow night at 8. Forecast says lows in the 50s tonight, mostly cloudy, for Friday highs around 70, partly sunny. In a few minutes on Song Travels, Grammy-winning singer and pianist Diane Schur talks with Michael Feinstein about her work and plays, sings, and spins a few favorite tunes, including I Get Along Without You Very Well and The Very Thought of You, beginning in just a few minutes at 10 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from Puget Sound Blood Center, serving patients in 80 hospitals across the Pacific Northwest. Blood donations this summer will make a difference. Information is at psbc.org/donate. Puget Sound Blood Center, saving lives every day. Support for KUOW comes from University Bookstore, an independent bookseller with 9 locations that offer thousands of new and used titles, Husky gear, and gift items. Learn more about upcoming author events and store locations at ubookstore.com.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, this is part 3 of today's Speakers Forum. Our guest is the American theater icon Tony Kushner, in conversation with Seattle writer and editor Dan Savage. In this last segment, Kushner answers questions from the audience at Town Hall Seattle.
So from Christine via email, which of your other plays do you wish got as much attention and as many productions as Angels?
I think the play that I'm still probably proudest of, I'm very proud of Angels in America, is Carolina or Change. I really love it a lot. It's in a way easy to be proud of it because it's only half mine, it's half Janine's. I think she's a great composer, and I think the score is astonishing. But it's gotten a lot of attention. I mean, it has been everywhere except Seattle, weirdly, but it's been everywhere else. Otherwise, I don't really have any complaints. I feel like plays find the audience they're meant to find. I knew the minute Angels happened, it would never happen again in my lifetime, to me, and that my obituary is going to say the author of Angels in America is dead. Hopefully not. Hooray, hooray. I was a very close friends with Maurice Sendak, and we did a book together, and we went on a book tour where he signed it, and there was lines around the block of people, and they all had Where the Wild Things Are. Maurice wrote and illustrated over like 90 books, and wrote and illustrated at least 18, I think. And some of them are masterpieces, absolutely as great as Where the Wild Things Are. In the Night Kitchen, Higgledy Piggledy Pop, which is, I think, one of the great works about death and dying in all of Western literature and art. I think he was a great artist. And, you know, it was as though he had done this one book, and it was the one that everybody brought. And, you know, it used to pain him, but, you know, he also was like, okay, but I'd rather have that than not have it. And I feel that way. I'm happy. Angels is still going strong, and that makes me very glad.
This question is from Mark in New York City. Why you still don't get that you have got to wash the food off before loading the dishwasher? I was DMing with your husband and asked him if there's anything you wanted me to put to you on stage today, and this was it. I was hoping for something a lot more embarrassing.
Did he really say that?
Yes.
Because the dishwasher actually gets most of the food off most of the time. And since I'm always the one who loads the dishwasher, were I to wash the time I would lose in rinsing off all the dishes all the time would add up to a lot more than the time that I lose washing off the occasional little sort of stuck-on piece of food, and you know, fighting with Mark about rinsing the dishes.
It was really funny that that's what he came with. I was chatting with him earlier that the dishwasher is actually a point of contention in my marriage as well, because Terry believes it should be loaded in a very particular, meticulous, organized way, but he won't do it himself. He wants to do a tutorial once in a while.
Yes.
in a rage.
Maybe we're married to the same person.
So if there were to be a part three to Angels in America that encompassed everything from the end of the original two to now, to 2014, what role would HIV/AIDS play in it? What themes? How would the HIV/AIDS theme extend? What story would you want to tell?
I mean, first of all, there won't ever be a third part because, you know, Godfather. I mean, I learned. Godfather 1, one of the greatest movies ever made. Godfather 2, absolutely, one of maybe the great, you know, greatest American film. Godfather 3, we'll talk about that. And it's like, I
Intelligent Guy doesn't have HIV/AIDS.
It's mentioned.
It's mentioned, but it's not.
It's not addressed.
And in your interview with The Stranger this week, you decried the disappearance of HIV/AIDS, its discussion, its mentions, as a problem, because it's still a global pandemic. It still disproportionately impacts gay men in America, and yet it doesn't seem like a topic you yourself are interested in.
I mean, because I'm not at all certain that I won't go back to writing about the epidemic, which is now not an epidemic. It's a global pandemic, and, you know, it's... what Dan's referring to, I mean, when we did the play in 2010 and its 20th anniversary revival at the Signature, you know, it occurred to me that there was a new kind of silence surrounding AIDS that in the early years of the epidemic, getting any kind of media attention to all these thousands of people who were dying from it was impossible because of homophobia. Now, because of first worldism, because of a you know, just obliviousness to the problems of the developing world, to an interference with news flowing from the parts of the globe that are most, you know, catastrophically affected with rampant HIV infection and all sorts of complications, it's kind of disappeared again. It's very hard to get anything like a sustained... And also nuclear numbing. It's the Robert J. Lifton problem. It's been around a long time. It's so devastating. You get to the point where you're just staring at this horror, and it doesn't look like a horror anymore. It's just the landscape. And I think that probably I will want to write about it again, but I don't write about topics. I mean, that's the thing. I do believe that Angels had a certain part to play at the moment that it appeared. When it appeared on Broadway in 93, it was right after Clinton had been elected for the first time. The antiretrovirals were really beginning to make an absolutely dramatic difference in longevity of you know, seropositive people, and things were really changing. And I think the country as a whole began to feel enough of a lessening of the pressure of those horrible first years to begin to mourn. And I mean, you know, when you're in a war, you mourn, but you mourn very differently than once peace is declared and then there's really room for full throttle grief to come out. And I think Angels arrived on Broadway. I mean, those first couple of years of the performances on Broadway, I mean, there was a lot of people that were there to see the play, but also to be in a room full of people who had lost people or who were dying or who were sick and weren't sure how they were going to do. And it's like the AIDS quilt. I mean, those things arrived at that moment and had an impact. And if the play has taught people about AIDS, if the productions all over the world have made people talk about gay people or, you know, AIDS in any way, I and a number of other writers have contributed to that, and I'm enormously proud of having done that. But I don't feel that the power of theater is primarily a polemic or pedagogical power. And I feel that maybe Brecht would hate me for saying this, but...
He's a long dead playwright.
But he's a long dead playwright. Not in my head, he's not. But I really have come to believe more and more, you know, Shakespeare and Midsummer Night's Dream, that it's the power of the dream for the dreamer, And that the deal that you make is, we'll show you things that are sometimes horrible to behold. The reason you'll come and watch them is that you're not expected to do anything about them. And then we are not asking that you remember or understand what you're seeing, or that we have any control over what it's going to do to you. You're going to decide that when you wake up. You can remember the dream. You can misremember the dream, although as Freud says, there's no real misremembering of dreams. But you can remember it 10 years later. You can remember it in the middle of a day, and it'll ruin your whole day, and you'll walk out in front of a bus. I mean, you know, any number of things are possible. But you have made this deal with your unconscious to get this punny little riddle play in your head while you're prone on your bed and no risk to yourself or anybody else. And that's the power, and it's an indirect power. You let it out there, and then it's up to the community and each individual in the community to know what it's going to do. So I've never felt that I could write a play about a topic. I've written a couple of one acts. I wrote the Laura Bush play that I wrote about her reading, you know, about, and it wasn't even about a topic. It was because I was so upset that there was this, I went and I spoke at this march, maybe the largest march in the history of New York City against the Iraq War. In the freezing cold, over a million people came out. My speech was terrible. I can't do the sort of butch thing on the stage. I just feel like, who am I kidding? So it didn't work. But the march, standing on that stage and looking at this sea of people, and it was like 16 degrees below zero, it was freezing, and all these decent people were out saying no to this war. And then the next day they said to Bush, what do you think of that? These marches, it was New York and all over the place. And he said, well, that's like a focus group on television. And I'm, and everybody was like, oh, that's so disgusting. I thought it was the only true thing the little jerk ever said, because that's what we were. We had given up, we had no representation or not enough representation in the halls of power to get what we wanted. So all we could do was let him know how unhappy we were, and then go home and get warm again, and the war happened. So I wrote that play in despair, and it was used, and I'm really proud of it, again, that it was done by anti-war groups all over the country. But it's, if you listen to it really carefully, it's a complicated little thing, and I just don't think that, I'm not a good propagandist or, you know, sort of creative public service, and I'm not denigrating public service announcements, they're important, but I don't know that my work or that theater in general really functions at its best doing that. So something's going to have to happen where I start to feel, oh, there's some story here, there's something here that I can plunge into, and then we'll see. I'm not long dead yet, so who knows? We'll see what happens.
Tony Kushner.
Dan Sam.
Fountain's not flowing now. They turn it off in the winter. Ice in the pipes. But in the summer, it's a sight to see. I want to be around to see it. I plan to be. I hope to be. This disease will be the end of many of us, but not nearly all. And the dead will be commemorated, and we'll struggle on with the living, and we are not going away. We won't die secret deaths anymore. The world only spins forward. We will be citizens. The time has come. Bye now. You are fabulous, each and every one. And I bless you. More life. The great work begins.
You've been listening to playwright Tony Kushner in a conversation with The Strangers' Dan Savage. We recorded this on May 10th, 2014 at Town Hall Seattle. The Intimon Theater Festival presented this event. They'll be staging Angels in America this summer, opening August 12th. To listen again to this talk and many others, go to our website, kuow.org/.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.